And our business commentator today is Rebecca Stevenson. Rebecca is the head of news at Business Desk. Good morning and welcome.
Morning.
We were expecting a capital raising from Air New Zealand, probably actually around about now. And that now appears to be delayed, and instead we are seeing a new arrangement with the government over the loan facility. What's going on at the moment?
Well, basically, the airline has just bought itself a little more time. And in fact, you know, ANZ CEO Greg Foran has effectively called it wiggle room. You know, he said the renegotiated credit facility gives it wiggle room to delay that capital raising. Basically, they just want to understand actually what's going to happen, as some things are beginning to move now in terms of international travel, obviously with the announcement of the bubble with Australia there and the rolling out of vaccination programs and things like that. So Air New Zealand have managed to talk to the government and renegotiate and get some new debt and renegotiate the terms of that debt that it originally got from the government last year. There was quite a lot of criticism of that first credit facility that was negotiated because of the terms of the interest. In the first tranches, I think it was about up to 8 or 9%. With this new deal that's been renegotiated, and as well as the additional funds, it's a much lower interest rate for the airline. I think that first tranche is around 3%, and then the second tranche around 5%. So obviously, better terms there for the airline. We do still expect them to do a capital raise, and part of that will be that they will need to repay the Crown the money that they have been floated to get them through this time. The Crown has said that they want to be involved in that capital raise. They are the majority shareholder of Air New Zealand at about 52%, and they want to hold on to that. So they don't intend to backslide in any regard. So for me, it really is about just having to delay that capital raise and just letting them assess the situation. It's just been such a phenomenally disturbed time for the aviation industry. This just helps them kick that can down the road a little bit.
So they've drawn how much from the credit? Because they had the initial $900 million credit facility the government offered them at the outbreak of COVID. And they've now drawn...
They've got $1.5 billion now.
Right, so that's been, so they've drawn some of that initial facility and now it's been extended as well. So that, what I'm saying is they didn't burn through what they were initially extended.
No, they spent about $350 million of that first credit line, so they certainly weren't going out there blowing cash like crazy. You know, they've been very controlled with their costs. They've gone through and cut things as much as they can, and obviously, you know, we've seen the devastating personal impacts of that with staff being let go and things like that, but they've been very careful at what they're burning, because obviously when you have a very big business like Air New Zealand, they burn millions of dollars
a week.
Just existing. Yeah. So there's just some things they've had to obviously keep paying in time.
So when will they be in a clearer position to go to the market and raise capital? We know they've got planes parked up in the desert in Arizona or somewhere, right? Lots of planes. And staff furloughed. They're getting some kind of an injection of activity with the opening of the bubble. In fact, I think we're back to something like 50% of Trans-Tasman seats pre-COVID might be becoming available with the opening of this bubble. But that's still small fry in the context of it's important, but it's still, you know, only a slice of previous size business. So at what point are they going to be in a position to say to investors, this is what we think our shape as an airline is going to be, and this is what we think our revenue is going to be going into 2022 and beyond?
Well, the current date that they're sort of talking about now is September, but even in making those statements, Air New Zealand CEO Greg Foran made the comment to Business Desk, you know, if we don't raise capital in September, we can go for longer. So there's no set date on that either. And I guess from the airline's perspective, this is where it becomes actually quite useful to have such a major shareholder like the government, who has a massive balance sheet in which it can offer them, you know, this funding to get them through so they can keep assessing opening up opening up routes and working out what cash they're actually going to have, because they want to do this capital raise once. You know, the last thing they will want to be doing is to be needing more money, and to go out to investors like that would be quite destabilising. But obviously the investing industry is very keen for details around the capital raise, because we could potentially see the government increase its shareholding during that process.
Let's
we
come
just
to
don't
that,
know.
Because that's significant. But yeah. just first things first, could they simply not agree, Treasury, government and Air New Zealand, on what the future looked like right now? And it would not be surprising if that were the case. They simply couldn't have a credible enough scenario or range of scenarios to go to the public. Do we think that's the other issue? They just couldn't agree.
I don't know if that's it. I mean, in our off-the-record chats, we are not hearing that there's a lot of disquiet or unhappiness coming out of Air New Zealand about right. its negotiations with the government. I think Greg Foran is pretty pragmatic. You know, he's a big job guy. He knows what this is like. There is a sense, in what I'm hearing, that perhaps under the previous chief executive with Luxon, perhaps Air New Zealand had drifted a little too far from the fold for the government's liking. And the sort of sense I'm getting from people I'm talking to in Air New Zealand is that they are not unhappy with how things are playing out with their relationship with the shareholding minister,
well, let's
Finance
talk about
Minister
that.
Grant Robinson.
Let's talk about that, because there was criticism, and actually the former New Zealand First MP was Shane Jones, was not backwards and coming forwards, including on this show, at what was happening to some of the regional route service under the former CEO, Chris Luxon. And we had this hubbing out of Auckland, and we had a lot of questions around whether there were sufficiently good services being provided between the provinces and Auckland and Wellington, which is where a lot of business gets done. Lots changed since then. One of the issues around what happens with the capital raising is whether the government does increase its shareholding, and allied to that, whether it also expects or will signal a greater say in how things happen. And the New Zealand Herald's Fran O'Sullivan wrote at some length about this when this story came out a couple of days ago. You know, what are we hearing about that? Because there is very much a hands-off approach with a 52% shareholding, and the business is allowed to get on and run the business as it sees fit. Is there a possibility that in the unique circumstances we are in post-COVID, and particularly if the government wraps up its shareholding, it might be a little bit more hands-on?
I can't see that. I mean, the rules are fairly clear in terms of how the mixed ownership model has to work. You know, it is obviously different if it's a state-owned enterprise and the government is the total shareholder versus these companies like the energy companies and Air New Zealand, where they're listed on the NZX. They do still need to adhere to those NZX listing rules. And this becomes important when you come to things like board appointments and things like that. But if you actually read the sort of things about those rules, you know, the government is involved. You know, Grant Robinson, as the shareholding minister, as the finance minister, does write letters to the chairs of those MOM or mixed ownership model businesses and tell them, you know, what he thinks about their strategy. You know, they are informed about board appointments and things like that, you know. It's not that they don't already know what's going on. They are the major shareholder of these businesses, you know, and he routinely would write these kind of letters. I mean, it's not unusual for him to write letters to Air New Zealand. Well, he wrote a pretty pointy one.
This to the Reserve Bank.
Back in, well exactly the classic was with Adrian Orr, but what have we actually seen Adrian Orr do after that? Well, actually not much. So, you know, he can write these letters.
So is it potentially jawboning? Because also in Fran's article, June 2018, she says the finance minister wrote to the chairs of the three electricity generation companies and Air New Zealand, actually, under its previous previous CEO, saying shareholding ministers continue to reserve the right to nominate and vote for their own candidates as directors and to vote against board nominated candidates. Is that a bit of jawboning, saying we want you to pay heed to the concerns we have or the priorities we have for the way you run your companies, and if you don't, we can have a heavier hand?
Yeah, I mean, he, like you say, you know, he wrote to Tony Carter, who was the former Air New Zealand chair in 2018, effectively reminding him that it was time for him to leave.
That's right, I've forgotten about that.
I mean, they will say these things. It is quite clear in the documentation around those companies that they do have say-so over the appointment of the board chair in particular, and that, you know, those things are floated past them. There has been some criticism of the Air New Zealand board in particular over the last year, feeling that they don't have enough aviation experience. There is concern about that board inside the industry. So it'd be really interesting to see if there are any particular changes that come in. I mean, the thing is, they have to adhere to those NZX rules, which is that the board puts forward the nominations. However, there will be always this information flow in the background to that shareholding minister of finance, Minister Grant Robinson. So he's not going to be blindsided by anything. But it does appear that there's a little bit of freshness in this new letter. A lot of the stuff around the domestic routes and things like that, he'd actually already said this year in a letter to Air New Zealand when he committed to their capital raise. The one part that did stick out to me was new was talking about the board renewal process. And I think he's picking up there on the vibe that's actually quite sort of widely held, really, that perhaps they do need a little more aviation experience on that board.
That interest rate, by the way, was enormous for whatever portion of the initial credit line got drawn down. I think it's been dropped back a little for this additional credit line, and reminding ourselves it is a line. You don't have to draw on it until you have to. But I think it's dropped significantly. I think it's down to a new top rate of 5.3%, down from 9%, which, you know, in current interest rate environment is kind of hair-raising and is a disincentive, as we said, to go willy-nilly drawing on it. OK, well, a lot to learn, and obviously a lot to learn about what impact the bubble has, which we await to see. And we will await and see later in the year if capital raising does go ahead. Now, to your other story today, which is the four-day week. More companies trialling this.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? And even, you know, nations looking at it more widely. Now, obviously, in New Zealand, I think you'd possibly been under a rock if you've managed to miss Andrew Barnes' campaign for the four-day week. He has been very outspoken on a number of years about the need for businesses to shift to a four-day week. His business, which was Perpetual Guardian, they shifted to a four-day week in about 2018. They had a really successful trial. They claimed that their productivity and increased by about 20% during the trial, and that their staff were more engaged and more enthusiastic. Barnes has said there is no downside to introducing the four-day week, and he says, "We have proven the concept and developed a model workable for our business and established KPIs for our leaders to ensure productivity and customer service are maintained." We're seeing a trial in Spain now. We're also seeing in England sort of movements for unionists there towards a four-day week. It's a really interesting idea. We know that we have terrible problems with productivity in New Zealand. Our productivity is pretty woeful, and it has been for decades. We work really long hours, and we're not as productive as our peers. So I certainly feel that, you know, flexibility and giving people the ability to work when they're going to be most productive is definitely something that businesses should be thinking about. You know, we need to look at all of the options, really, to try and be more productive so that our workers get better paid for shorter hours, effectively.
Have we seen other New Zealand companies follow to the extent that Perpetual Guardian has? I'm just trying to think.
There have been some others. I was reading a story recently which talked about a trans-Tasman company, Mana Communications, talking about, you know, that it's just so outdated to have a 40-hour, 9-to-5 week, so they've switched to a 4-day week. But unlike Perpetual, they actually shortened their salaries, whereas with Perpetual, they kept it the same across the 4 days, but they were kind of working longer hours across those days.
It works. It's a bit like the work from home stuff. It works in industries where you can measure productivity cleanly, you know, X amount of output from X worker or X team. It's a little bit trickier to measure where things are a bit more mix and match, I think.
And the other issue as well is that a lot of the times it's kind of white-collar, middle-class jobs that are applicable to work a four-day week, whereas for a lot of other businesses and lower-income jobs, you know, they're not going to offer this kind of flexibility.
Well, maybe they should, because I do recall talking to, this was when, was it Vodafone? Oh, no, Vodafone was promoting the whole work from your holiday home. Yeah. I had very mixed feelings about, I must admit. I know what they were saying. But there was another researcher at the time talking about the fact that a lot of productivity in the likes of factory or blue-collar work, if you just released the workers to sort how they were working, then you'd get these significant productivity gains because they knew what they were doing. They knew what was inefficient.
Yeah.
But, of course, we still have one of the traits of organisations in this country that drives me mad is that we're still stuck in the top-down mentality, that people who sit around tables somewhere somehow know the most effective or efficient or productive way for people to work and not the people actually doing the work. So you do wonder if there is actually room, if you just freed up the factory floor to say, OK, how could we do this better?
There's an absolutely fabulous Reddit on subreddit, which is called Malicious Compliance. And often it's examples of where people are just following the rules at work, but it's ridiculous scenarios that are costing the businesses money, making the customers unhappy and irritating your workers. And I think you're exactly right. You know, we must empower our workers to make good decisions. You know, there's a reason that we've hired people. We should trust them and empower them to get the job done. Obviously, if they're not getting the job done, then you need to address that. But we shouldn't have so much stringency that people cannot work effectively. And I think often we've been a bit office-bound in that culture, like an idea that we have to see you and eyeball you and be watching what you're doing to make sure that you're working, when really, if people are losing, for example, in Auckland, 2 hours to commute to and from work, well, what's the point? I'd say we really need to unshackle.
It's more that sort of 1950s model that, you have these people at the top and then these people in the middle and then these people, and it's the people in the middle and the top who are making the decisions about how best to operate on the ground floor. And no one seems to be asking the people on the ground floor. Or at least they'll ask them and then go ahead and do with what they planned initially. It's like that sort of, I don't even know what era it dates from. Maybe the 90s, actually.
I think it is quite 90s, actually.
Yeah. You want to get more and more horizontal. You want people making real-time practice changes, or at least in trying out real-time practice changes and then communicating with others they are directly affected by, rather than everything having to go up through a chain and then back down through a chain, having been undone on the way.
Well, there has been a big push towards sort of unshackling from that. I don't know if you remember, but a couple of years ago, agile was the big buzzword. And a lot of about what agile was about was actually dismantling the hierarchy and getting people just to work on specific tasks together. And a lot of that was, hot desking, flexible working. But, often what happens is the people who are doing the work are telling management what needs to be done. Management then will hire a consultant for a lot of money who will come in and then tell them what the people on the floor have been telling them to be done. I mean, we see this all the time. You need to listen to your staff more. If they're finding efficient and effective ways of automating systems and doing their jobs better, listen to your staff.
But that separation even, and this is where I think it is a 90s thing, between management and people actually doing things. With all the technological and productivity gains we've had through technology, there shouldn't be that kind of separation necessary to the extent that it is, right? You should almost be sort of one and the same in a lot of these roles.
Yeah, effectively. I mean, there does need to be a hierarchy at a certain point, I think news is a good example. At the end of the day, an editor needs to decide what the word is. There's always going to be scenarios like that. But when it's sort of routine jobs that someone else is doing and taking ownership for, you should let them lead it and make those decisions about how they think it will best be done.
Interesting stuff. Nothing will change between now and next time I talk anyway to you, but thank you for the discussion. Rebecca Stevenson.
Thanks.
She is NewsDesk's head of news.